Earlier this morning, I wrote this number up on the board. I realize now that probably some of you over here can't see it. It's 0.000 followed by 7 sets of 1100. I'd ask if you knew what that number was, but I suspect you don't, so I'm going to tell you. On February 25th, 1991, during the Gulf War, a Scud missile was launched by the Iraqis at a U.S. Army barracks in Dayran, Saudi Arabia. This particular barrack, as most barracks were at the time, was equipped with a Patriot missile battery, which was capable of destroying the Scud missiles mid-flight before it ever reached its target. However, on this particular day, no Patriot missile was ever launched, and the Scud missile struck the base, killing 28 soldiers and injuring nearly 100 other individuals. So what happened? Well, this number is what happened. The defense system for this base, which included the Patriot missiles, had a minuscule problem. The system's internal clock was rounding a very, very small number, which it used to calculate time. Specifically, the system used a calculation to determine each 1/10 of a second. And the number that it used to determine how much time 1/10 of a second was this particular number up here. The system, though, truncated the number. It rounded the number. It couldn't handle this particular set of numbers. And so instead of providing this number in the system to calculate 1/10 of a second, it eliminated these last two sets. So it was only wrong by 0.00. Anybody know what that number is? I thought I asked my congressman, but this is a number even too big for them, or too little. This is something on the order of 1/septillionth off. To put it into perspective, there's 1,000,000, then 1 billion, then 1 trillion, then 1 quadrillion, 1 quintillion, 1 sextillion, then 1 septillion. 1/septillionth of a second off. But every 1/10 of a second, this problem got just that much more bigger. As long as the system was not rebooted, the error never became large enough for the operators to notice. However, on February 25th, 1991, the system had been in operation for 100 hours since the last time it was rebooted at the time of the Scud missile launch. By this time, the error had multiplied itself 3.6 million times, and the system was off by only a fraction of a second. In fact, it was only off by a little over 1/3 of a second. And so on this day, the radar system successfully detected the Scud missile and predicted where to look for it next. However, because of this time error, it looked in the wrong part of the sky and didn't find the missile. Scud missiles move at something like 1,600 kilometers per second. So in 1/3 of a second, it had basically traveled 1/3 of a mile. And the radar system didn't see a Scud missile in the part of the sky that it was looking at because it was 1/3 of a mile off. And so, without a missile on the radar system, the initial detection was assumed to be erroneous, and the missile was removed from the system. No interception attempt was attempted, and the Scud missile hit its target. Even after 100 hours, the system was only off by 1/3 of a second. Three-tenths of a second. It was almost accurate. Can you think about that? Almost accurate. But yet, it really wasn't accurate at all. You know, the word almost is a term that completely changes a sentence and negates the action. The word almost is sometimes used to soften the reality of a situation. But the practical truth is that almost is the same as saying not at all. This morning we're going to look at some situations in the Bible where almost just wasn't good enough. In 2 Samuel, the 8th chapter, we read a brief statement about David and the nation of Edom. And this is what it says in verse 14. 2 Samuel 8:14. He, being David, he also put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom, he put garrisons. And all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Now, if this was the only passage that we knew of David's encounters with the Edomites, we would assume that during David's reign, his time with the Edomites was relatively peaceful. I mean, I read this passage and I think, all right, David put some of his army in the nation of Edom. Okay. And they became his servants. All right, that sounds like a pretty peaceful process. But that's not really how it went. After David died, we actually find out more about this situation in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. So David has reigned. He reigned something like 40 years, and then he dies. And right after he dies, we learn more about what happened here in Edom. In 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, we find out that David and Joab had been fighting with the Edomites. And David was out to completely annihilate the Edomites. He was going to wipe them off of the face of the earth. After David returned to Israel, he left Joab there for 6 months to kill every male Edomite. And he almost got it done. Almost. Let's look at 1 Kings chapter 11. I'm going to read verses 14 through 22. Now the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was a descendant of the king of Edom. For it happened when David was in Edom, and Joab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain, after he had killed every male in Edom, because for 6 months Joab remained there with all Israel, until he had cut down every male in Edom. Then Hadad fled to go to Egypt, he and certain Edomites of his father's servants with him. Hadad was still a little child. Then they arose from Midian and came to Paran, and he took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house, apportioned food for him, and gave him land. And Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, so that he gave him as wife the sister of his own wife, that is, the sister of Queen Tophanes. Then the sister of Tophanes bore him Jenobath, his son, whom Tophanes weaned at Pharaoh's house. And Jenobath was in Pharaoh's household among the sons of Pharaoh. So when Hadad heard in Egypt that David rested with his fathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me depart, that I may go to my own country." Then Pharaoh said to him, "But what have you lacked with me, that suddenly you seek to go to your own country?" So he answered, "Nothing, but do let me go anyway." So here's this guy, Hadad. He was an Edomite, and David and Joab were out to kill all the Edomites. In fact, Joab spent 6 months tracking down and killing every male Edomite. And as far as we know, he got every male Edomite except for one. Now, there may have been more, but he wasn't able to get Hadad because Hadad escaped. Hadad went to Egypt, and there he waited. And when David died, Hadad asked Pharaoh if he could go home. Now, I don't think Hadad was only interested in going home, because if we read a little bit further down in 1 Kings 11, verse 25 this time, it says that Hadad caused trouble for Solomon. Now, I don't know what kind of trouble that was, and we really can't be very sure. But in context, it appears that Hadad must have caused some kind of trouble in raiding. That maybe he got a band of Edomites together, descendants of the women of Edom, and raided Israel. I don't know that. It's sort of speculation. What we do know is that David and Joab didn't get the job done. They almost wiped out the Edomites. But Hadad came back, and Hadad caused trouble. In 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, God commands Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And Saul does most of his job. I appreciate Travis reading this for us, because Saul does most of the job, doesn't he? He almost wipes out the Amalekites. He saves some of their animals, and he spares the king, King Agag. In 1 Samuel 15 and 9, Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless, that they were utterly destroyed. So God sends Samuel to Saul to rebuke him for not following his instructions. You see, Saul almost got it right. He almost followed the will of God. And even though when Saul is confronted by Samuel, you remember what Travis read to us? Samuel says, well, how come you didn't complete the job? And Saul says, hey, we did it. We followed the will of God. And on top of all of that, look, I've got all of these animals that we're going to sacrifice to God. Saul didn't do the job that God had asked him to do. He almost got it right, but not quite. And even though this particular shortcoming we'll bring up again, it's not the point I want to make. When Samuel arrives, he rebukes Saul for not killing the animals. And we have a very well-known Old Testament verse in verse 22 where we're told, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. But what happened to King Agag? Well, if we would have read on a little bit further in the chapter, we'd see in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 32 and 33, then Samuel said, bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me. So Agag came to him cautiously, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hacked Agag into pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. You see, Saul didn't get the job done. He left Agag. And as a result, Samuel had to finish the job. But that's not the end of the story. Let's go some 550 years later, and let's turn to the book of Esther. In Esther chapter 3, the chapter begins with this. And after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Did you hear that? Haman was a what? Haman was an Agagite. Somehow, someone from the Amalekites, someone from the descendants of Agag got free. Now, if we didn't know this, if we weren't told this in Esther chapter 3, we wouldn't have known that. But Saul didn't even get the whole job done. Even after Samuel killed Agag, still Saul only got half of it right. He almost got it right, but someone escaped. Someone from the Amalekites of the descendants of Agag got away. Some 550 years later, after Saul almost wiped out the Amalekites, the children of Israel are at risk of what? What was Haman's mission? He was so upset that Mordecai wouldn't bow to him that he made it his mission to wipe out the children of Israel. And he almost got it done, didn't he? Because Haman convinced the king to sign a law that would destroy all of the Jews. And it almost happened. But why did it almost happen? It almost happened because somebody else almost did their job. These two stories, Haman and Hadad, are stories about men who should never have existed. They just shouldn't have been there. We should not be reading about Haman. We should not be reading about Hadad. They only came to be because someone almost destroyed their people. Almost. But they left a little bit of remnant. So let me ask you this question. Have you completely removed sin from your life? And I don't necessarily mean all sin. I mean maybe a particular sin. Is it completely gone? Or is it almost gone? You see, almost isn't good enough. Just like Hadad and Haman, if you leave a remnant of sin in your life, it will come back to bite you. And it might not be right away. It might lie in wait. It might take a few years. It might take decades. But if you don't completely remove sin, if you leave a remnant, you're at risk. Consider what we're told in Matthew chapter 12, verses 43 through 45. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest, and finds none. And he said, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of the man is worse than the first. So it shall be with this wicked generation. Think about this. Here is this man who has an unclean spirit. I think we can liken sin to that unclean spirit. You get rid of it, and you don't really do anything to replace it. And then it comes back. And it finds you exactly the same way that it left you. And sin that's almost gone is just like that spirit. It's almost gone. And when it comes back, what's it going to find? It's going to find you just the same way you were. Consider these particular statistics. I'm going to say this word wrong. Recidivism. R-E-C-I-D-I-V-I-S-M. It's about people who go to prison and then go back to prison. That's the idea. Among the 30,000 soldiers, in a particular study I found, among the 300,000 prisoners released from 15 states, 67% of them were rearrested within 3 years. Of those released prisoners, the highest rate of rearrest were among robbers at 70%, burglars at 74%, which I didn't know there was a difference between a robber and a burglar, but apparently there is. It's a 4% difference. That's the difference. Larcenists, 74.6%. Motor vehicle thieves, 79%. Those who were in prison for selling stolen property, 77%. Those for possessing, using, or selling a legal weapon, 70%. What does this tell you? Well, it tells you that that spirit came back and it found the house clean, set in order, ready to sin again. And you know, these are criminals. Oh, well, I'm not a criminal. Well, have you transgressed the law of God? Think about it for a minute. How many times have you said, I'm going to get over this sin? And you do, and then it comes back. And then you think, why did I fail? Well, you failed because you almost got rid of sin. You almost had it beat. But almost is like not at all. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 11. As a dog returns to its own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. Did you know that your body is made up of something like 50 trillion cells, all working together in a prescribed fashion to make your body work? Each cell does its part to support and maintain the entire body. And cancer literally begins with one cell. One of 50 trillion cells decides that it's going to do its own thing. It's going to be selfish. It's going to not do what it's supposed to do. That cancer cell chooses to live and grow independent of the rules of the body in which it lives in. And as a result, the cancer multiplies, grows uncontrolled. It eventually steals nutrients from the cells in your body that are trying to do the right thing. And it eventually kills the person, even killing itself in the process. one cell in 50 trillion is enough to kill you. You ever thought about that? Wow. Hadad, Haman, and sin are just like that one cell that's gone out of control. Maybe it's like that one cell that was left over after surgery. You know, how much confidence are you going to have in your physician if you are diagnosed with cancer and they come to you and they say, I almost got it all. All right. Well, almost just isn't good enough. We wouldn't accept that of the physician who's taking care of us. Why would God accept that from us? God, I almost got sin out of my life. If you leave a remnant, whether it's just one cell, it'll eventually grow and eventually kill you. One cell is just enough to kill you. You know, even though I think sin can easily be compared to cancer, the Bible doesn't use that comparison. Cancer is mentioned in the Bible. It's only mentioned one time, and it's mentioned in comparison to false teaching. And I think that brings us to our next point that I want to bring. Can we be almost right in doctrine? Absolutely, we can be almost right in doctrine. But it's still not right, is it? It's still not right in doctrine. In 2 Timothy, the second chapter, verses 17 and 18, Paul confronts two men, Hymenaeus and Philetus, about the teachings of their doctrinal teachings about the resurrection of the dead. They were teaching that the resurrection was already past, and as a result, they were erring from the truth. It appears as though everything else that they had been teaching was pretty accurate. But there was this one issue, this one thing that they were almost right in, but they weren't right. And that is that they were teaching that the resurrection had already passed. And Paul says that this doctrine was spreading like cancer. You know, cancer grows. It's great at growing. It's not the right kind of growth that you want, but it does grow. And you know, these men, they were almost right, but in the end, they ended up being completely wrong. And you know, false teaching is just like that, isn't it? It could be the teaching about the resurrection. It could be a teaching about any other issue. False teaching is almost true, but it's not true. Remember how Satan deceived Eve by almost telling the truth? He just changed one little word, didn't he? In Genesis chapter 3, verse 4, then the serpent said to woman, you will not surely die. I mean, it's just one little three-letter word. You will not surely die. It's almost the truth, but it's altogether wrong. Because false teaching is almost true, it is altogether dangerous. There was a man named Henry Ward Beecher. He was a Congregationalist preacher some around the 1700s, 1800s. His sister is Harriet Beecher Stowe, which would be maybe a name that you recognize better. I wish he would have listened to his own advice, but this is what he had to say. Whatever is almost true is quite false and among the most dangerous of errors, because being so near truth, it is more likely to be led astray. Isn't that interesting? False teaching is almost true, and yet it is the most dangerous of falsehoods, isn't it? Because it's so close to the truth. I can almost believe that. That seems to be about right. Well, it's about right. It's almost true, but it's not right and not true. There are dozens of Bible examples of people who almost followed the instructions of God. In Numbers, the 10th chapter, we read about Nadab and Abihu. They got everything right except for where they got the fire from when they burned incense to God. They offered strange fire, and as a result, they died. In Matthew, the 19th chapter, Jesus is confronted by a ruler. We often call him the rich young ruler, but I don't know that we know that he was young, but he certainly was rich and he certainly was a ruler. And he got everything right in the law except for one thing. He kept all the commandments, but he just couldn't part with his stuff. In 2 Kings, the 15th chapter, verse 3, this is what we read about Jeroboam. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. And then there's a comma. And if we just stop at verse 3, Jeroboam sounds like a great upstanding guy. He did all that was right in the sight of the Lord. But you know that verse 4 starts with the word except. Except that the high places were not removed, the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. That doesn't make Jeroboam sound really good, does it? Jeroboam did all of these good things, except he didn't tear down the idols. He allowed the people to continue to worship idols. Samson served God and executed his judgments, except Samson liked foreign women, didn't he? He loved the women of the Philistines. And as a result, what happened to Samson? Samson eventually lost his eyes. He lost his strength. And it was only when he prayed to God to kill him, to allow him to die and to take one final blow on the Philistines, that God gave him his strength back. Samson did a lot of great things for the Lord. He executed God's judgments, and yet in one thing he erred. Solomon, in 1 Kings, the third chapter, the third verse, we're told, "And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places." Solomon was almost right with God. Travis read 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, where Saul almost killed everyone and almost killed all of the animals. And think about what happened to Saul because of that. The whole kingdom was taken away from Saul because he didn't follow the will of God. He wasn't pure in following God's instructions. So can we be almost right in doctrine? Absolutely. But the end result is still the same. Almost right is altogether wrong. You remember that Scud missile we talked about in the beginning? Here's the sad reality. At the time of the attack, the Israelis had already identified the problem with the Patriot missile system. And they knew that the problem was the result of a calculation error. As minuscule as it was, they found it. They knew that this error could potentially cause problems. And they had informed the United States Army, and they had also informed the software manufacturer 2 weeks prior to the attack. At the time of the attack, no upgrade was available. As a stopgap measure, the Israelis recommended rebooting the computer system regularly. But U.S. Army officials didn't quite understand how often they needed to do this. They didn't understand the magnitude of being almost accurate, but not being completely accurate. On February 26, 1991, one day after the attack, the software manufacturer supplied the Army with the necessary updates to correct the error. They almost saved 28 lives. But in the end, they didn't. In the end, 28 people died because of a very small error. Because we were almost accurate, but not. In Acts, the 25th chapter and the 26th chapter, Paul is making his defense to King Agrippa. His defense was part defense and part sermon. And in the end, we know what Agrippa said. In Acts 26:28, Agrippa says to Paul, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian." Almost, but not quite. Actually, not at all. I don't know, you don't know, we just don't know if Agrippa ever took action. But if he never took that first step, and he stayed almost persuaded, he was altogether lost. I really don't know the condition of your soul, but if you're thinking about giving your life to Christ, don't be almost persuaded. Be altogether saved and baptized and wash away your sins. I want to tell you one other story of almost. In Numbers chapter 20. In Numbers chapter 20, Moses and Aaron go to a rock and break open the rock and water comes out. Now this has happened before. The children of Israel are wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. This is near the end of their wandering. And they almost got it right, didn't they? They had been faithful servants of God for 40 years, leading the children of Israel. And then, as they're on the cusp of entering the promised land, they did one thing wrong. They didn't give God the credit for the miracle that they were performing. Instead, they took credit from God. And as a result, in Numbers chapter 20, verse 28, God instructs Moses to take Aaron up onto a mountain where the whole people can see him, strip him of all of his priestly garments, and he died right there in front of all of the people. Aaron knew this was what was going to happen. Here's the promised land. I don't know how far away it was, but it was right there. It's the end of the 40 years. Their time in the wilderness was almost done. And yet, Aaron died. Because he almost served God. And I'm sure Moses was glad that in Deuteronomy chapter 31, that God gave him the opportunity to see the promised land. But in Deuteronomy 34, verse 3, God says to Moses, "You're going to see the promised land, but you won't be able to enter in." Almost. The wandering in the wilderness is an awful lot like our lives, isn't it? We were slaves to sin, bound in Egypt, figuratively. And God sends His deliverer to us through Jesus Christ. It's through baptism, just like the children of Israel walking through the Red Sea. It's through baptism that we're saved. That we have that opportunity to get away from our sins. But it's not over yet. We don't receive the promise. We still have to live our lives, don't we? And just like the children of Israel wandered for 40 years before they could enter the promised land, after we've been baptized, we have an opportunity to serve God for a time before He gives us the promise of our heavenly home. Don't be like Moses or Aaron and almost get there. How sad would that be to stand before God and say, "You got close. In fact, you were so close that it doesn't matter at all." Because in the end, there's either right or there's wrong. There's no almost right. Consider where your soul stands today should the Lord come back or should your life end. Would you be saved or would you be almost saved? Because almost saved is altogether lost. Consider your soul as we stand and sing the closing number.